Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. An uneven impact. Lower-income neighborhoods bear a disproportionate burden of the effects of the ongoing massive winter storm. Then, the resistance continues. Protests against the military coup in Myanmar grow despite internet restrictions and police crackdowns. And a return to the Red Planet. NASA sends another probe to Mars with ambitious goals in mind, including learning whether life ever existed on the now desolate surface.
When we get those samples back in the laboratory, that's what's going to give us our best opportunity to be able to say whether or not some of those molecules that we're finding were actually biologic molecules.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Most of the nation is still locked in the deep freeze tonight. A polar vortex that swept south is holding sway, claiming at least 30 lives and keeping the power off for nearly 3.4 million people. Stephanie Tsai begins our coverage.
All across the country, Americans grappled with a historic Arctic weather system for another long day.
It's so cold in the house, you can see my breath.
And a new round of winter weather threatened to engulf the southern and eastern parts of the country. The extreme conditions have left more than 100 million people under some type of winter storm warning or advisory.
Nothing.
And states from Nevada to Mississippi are still struggling with power outages after rolling blackouts were imposed. In hardest hit Texas,
power will not be restored fully, I would say, probably for another couple of days.
Warming centers have been set up to help those without heat.
It's 20 degrees now, which has warmed up. Yesterday, when I left my apartment at the retirement community, it was 1 degree.
80-year-old Willie Peterson hasn't had consistent power at his home on the outskirts of Dallas since last weekend.
On a personal level, I have done well. My kids care about me. I can manage for myself. But there are lots of people in our area who do not have choices. So the sadness for me is not personal. It's caring about these folks who were already marginalized and they can't go check into a hotel. They don't have relationships where they can go and sleep on someone's sofa.
Peterson is staying at his son's house, which has also been a refuge for others, housing up to 8 people. But right before we spoke with him, his son's house also lost power.
This is our neighborhood.
For Greta Griffin Hurd, a single mother in Lake Dallas, the worry is for her daughter, Maya.
What am I going to feed her? You know, can't cook anything, no electricity. So you're hoping you have enough in your cupboard that you can, you know, because you don't know how long this is going to last.
The temperatures have overwhelmed power grids in Texas and sparked misleading claims about what is to blame, including from the state's governor.
Our wind and our solar got shut down, and they were collectively more than 10% of our power grid. It just shows that fossil fuel is necessary.
Abbott later clarified that natural gas and coal generators also went down. In fact, natural gas, coal, and nuclear energy were responsible for nearly twice as many outages as renewable energy sources. Meanwhile, some COVID vaccination sites in Texas have closed, and in places like Georgia, the weather has delayed vaccine shipments. This as heavy ice and snow is expected from the Gulf up to New England over the next few days.
We now turn to two mayors managing this storm's impact. Mayor David Holt of Oklahoma City is joining us, as well as Mayor Harry LaRoselier of Plano, Texas. Mr. Mayors, thank you so much for joining the NewsHour. Mr. LaRoselier, I want to start with you. Describe what you're seeing in Plano, Texas today, the biggest obstacles. Is it still extremely dangerous for folks there?
Yes, it is. Really, what we're finding is that we're not prepared for this type of a weather event from a state level and really from a city level, I think, to clean up the streets and for people to feel safe out and about is challenging. And then the extreme pressure on our energy grid has created quite a bit of outages. And so we had up to 60,000 homes that were experiencing outages at the beginning, and it's down to about 14,000. There's still too many people that are in their homes and uncomfortable and not substandard living conditions.
And Mayor Holt, I know there in Oklahoma City, you're also experiencing power outages. Yesterday, you had a temperature below minus 14 degrees, which set a record that hasn't been set since 1899. You also have your governor, who is asking for a federal declaration, a disaster declaration for all the counties there. What are the biggest challenges for you there in Oklahoma City?
Well, I think four things come to mind. Water. We have got 30 line breaks across our city. We've got usage that is double what it would normally be this time of year. So between the high usage and the water breaks, we've got low pressure across the city. So we're trying to manage that. And the breaks obviously come from the preposterously low temperatures that you just referred to. I think the second thing is the energy grid, and Mayor Harry referred to that just now. That's obviously been an issue. The electric utility is separate from the city, and we're fully aware now that it's subject to a multi-state, governance. But that's something that it definitely affected us on Tuesday with rolling blackouts across the city. We're also dealing with, people sleeping outside and those experiencing homelessness. And as a community, we spent days, if not weeks, preparing for that. And so I'm pleased that there's enough capacity and there's a lot of people trying to get out there to bring those people indoors. Unfortunately, we had our first fatality in Oklahoma City earlier today. And so that was what we had feared. We hope that that's the last one. And then the last thing are the roads. We're a 620 square mile city. It is very difficult, obviously, for us to plow the roads. We focus on snow routes. But I would say, fortunately, to this point, our residents have largely stayed home. That's what we've asked them to do. That's partly why our water usage is so high. But they have stayed home, and we haven't yet really encountered what could be a very problematic situation as this drags on.
Mayor LaRosillier, I want to follow up on this power grid issue in Texas. I spoke to Texans today, including an 80-year-old man, who have been for days without power in sub-zero temperatures or sub-freezing temperatures. Who do you hold accountable for that?
I think any elected official, including myself, that's not focusing on a solution right now is not using our time effectively. We have plenty of time to do the recount of what went wrong and what could have done better and ascribe the responsibility to the right party. But for now, I'm just focused on helping our citizens.
Mayor Holt, I know Oklahoma is also a big energy producing state. Texas Governor Greg Abbott and others have used this moment to say that renewable energy sources are not reliable. I wonder what you think about those that are using this moment to make that point, which isn't really borne out with the facts here. The fact is oil, gas, and nuclear all went offline during this storm.
Yeah, well, oil and gas have always been a big part of Oklahoma City's economy, and obviously we support those energy sources. But we've also been a community that has embraced wind. There's a lot of wind in Oklahoma, and our local utility provider, OG&E, uses wind to a great extent. Wind has been challenged in this particular situation because the turbines literally, froze in place. But I don't think that necessarily is something that would cause you to abandon a diverse energy, resource, because not every situation is going to be this one. This was a once in a generation lowering of temperatures combined with massive snow. We don't see that kind of weather mix here in Oklahoma very often.
Mayor LaRosillier, you mentioned solutions, and climate change experts say we should expect more of these extreme weather events. I wonder if this experience has made you think cities do need to be built to be more resilient against these extreme weather incidents.
Absolutely. We've taken proactive measures here in Plano to be more resilient and be prepared for weather events such as this, but certainly not to this extent. This is way past what we actually have prepared for. But it does speak to more of a regional and state level coordination that's required in order for these type of events that seem to be happening more frequently be addressed in a more coordinated manner.
Mayor Holt, what about you? Do cities need to be built to be more resilient against climate change?
Well, if we're a place like Oklahoma City, that means we need to be more prepared for this not to be a once in a generation event and that it's going to have to be more common, then yes. I mean, we really probably need to get some pretty smart people around a table to tell us that this is going to happen more often, because otherwise we probably wouldn't over prepare. You know, we're probably not going to build a city that is ready to have sub-zero temperatures for a week every year. That would be too expensive. Our taxpayers wouldn't want to do that. They'd rather just muddle through once every 20 years a situation like this. But if it's going to happen more often, I obviously cities like ours are going to have some tough conversations. And it seems like the last few years, I can admit that we are using the phrase 50-year storm or once in a generation event more and more often.
We certainly hope that the residents of both of your cities get through this current storm and that we don't have more of these extreme weather events. Mayor David Holt of Oklahoma City and Mayor Harry LaRosiliere of Plano, Texas. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In the day's other news, the White House COVID task force reported an average of 1.7 million Americans are being vaccinated daily. It was under 1 million a month ago. But the task force also said that Johnson & Johnson has only a few million doses of its vaccine ready to distribute once it's approved. In a town hall last night, President Biden projected that enough vaccine will be available to inoculate all Americans by the end of July. The UN Secretary General is pleading for a more equitable distribution of COVID vaccines worldwide. Antonio Guterres said today that just 10 countries have administered 75% of all vaccinations so far, and that 130 countries have received no vaccine. He called it wildly uneven and unfair.
The rollout of COVID-19 vaccines is generating hope. But at this critical moment, vaccine equity is the biggest moral test before the global community. We must ensure that everybody, everywhere can be vaccinated as soon as possible.
Meanwhile, Japan finally launched its vaccination campaign, beginning with medical workers. The late rollout has raised concerns about whether Japan can be ready to host the delayed 2020 Summer Olympics this July. President Biden called in labor leaders today to lobby for his COVID relief package, totaling $1.9 trillion. They met in the Oval Office, and the president told them that, quote, it's not about the money, but about the nation's needs. Separately, he said that he had a good conversation today with Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu. They had not spoken since Mr. Biden took office. Europe's top human rights court ordered Russia today to release opposition leader Alexei Navalny from prison. The court suggested that Navalny's life is in danger. Moscow rejected the ruling as, quote, crude interference in Russia's judicial system. Navalny's imprisonment has also triggered mass protests across Russia. NATO leaders are urging the U.S. to consult before leaving Afghanistan. President Trump's deal with the Taliban set May 1st as a deadline for pulling out the remaining 2,500 Americans. The Biden administration is reviewing that agreement. In Brussels today, the NATO Secretary General called for careful consideration.
There are roughly 10,000 NATO troops in Afghanistan now, and the majority of them are not from the United States. And I think that demonstrates the value of NATO, also for the United States. Because the United States, when they went into Afghanistan, they didn't go alone.
NATO leaders also said that the Taliban must curtail ongoing violence. The U.S. Justice Department charged three North Koreans today in a scheme of cyber theft and revenge on behalf of their government. It included the 2014 attack on Sony Pictures Entertainment and an attempt to steal more than $1.3 billion from banks. None of the three suspects is in U.S. custody. Facebook has blocked Australians from viewing or sharing news on its platform. That action came today as the country's House of Representatives voted to make Facebook and Google pay for publishing Australian journalism. Google has responded by negotiating payment deals. South Carolina is about to become the latest state to ban nearly all abortions. It would be triggered once a fetal heartbeat is detected. Most Democrats in the state House walked out in protest for a time today, but majority Republicans ultimately passed the procedure or measure. The governor says that he will sign it after a final procedural vote tomorrow. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 90 points to close at 31,613. But the Nasdaq fell 82 points and the S&P 500 slipped 1 point. Britain's Prince Philip, who is 99, is in a London hospital tonight. Buckingham Palace says that the husband of Queen Elizabeth was feeling ill and that he will remain hospitalized for a few days. It is not believed related to COVID-19, as the prince has already been vaccinated. And talk radio host Rush Limbaugh died today. For more than 30 years, he trumpeted a brand of conservatism that won him a huge audience and condemnation. Lisa Desjardins looks at his career.
My friends, my name is Rush Limbaugh.
One of the most polarizing figures in American culture, Rush Limbaugh transformed talk radio and became a defining force in Republican politics. Born in Missouri, he started in radio in high school and dropped out of college to make it a career, one that became turbocharged in the 1980s after the Reagan era ended the Fairness Doctrine, allowing broadcasters to air one-sided political views. The Rush Limbaugh Show launched in 1988. Limbaugh was a brash, unapologetic conservative, shaming Republicans he found wishy-washy and railing against the left, urging ideological warfare, including here against President Barack Obama.
We're talking about it remaining the country we were all born into and reared and grown into. And it's under assault. It's always under assault. But it's never been under assault like this from within before. And it's a serious, serious battle.
But critics heard a voice for white male power. Limbaugh pushed the racist conspiracy theory that President Obama was born outside the United States. And he hurled slurs at college student and birth control advocate Sandra Fluke.
It makes you a slut, right? Makes you a prostitute.
Limbaugh's focus on culture war issues like immigration helped pave the way for Donald Trump.
It was a unique guy, and he was he became a friend of mine.
The former president called into Fox News today. In past months, Limbaugh amplified Mr. Trump's false claims of election fraud. Today, the former president stressed Limbaugh's support, including a call at the start of his campaign.
When we came down the escalator, he liked my rather controversial speech. I made that speech that was a little bit on the controversial side, and he loved it. He was with me right from the beginning.
Limbaugh announced his lung cancer diagnosis last February. And one day later, Mr. Trump awarded him with the Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian award, during the State of the Union address.
Rush Limbaugh, thank you for your decades of tireless devotion to our country.
His effect was on display, with Republicans standing and Democrats silent, some angry. Unusually, Limbaugh himself was speechless. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Lisa Desjardins.
Rush Limbaugh was 70 years old. Still to come on the NewsHour, protests against the military coup in Myanmar grow despite an ongoing crackdown. NASA returns to Mars, hoping to learn whether life ever existed on the now desolate planet. A doctor who faced the Ebola pandemic on the front lines provides lessons for COVID-19 and much more.
This is This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Before we get back to the show, I want to tell you about another podcast, Evil by Design from CBC Podcasts. Women from around the world have accused fast fashion mogul Peter Nygaard of sexual assault and human trafficking for decades, earning him the moniker Canada's Jeffrey Epstein. He denies it all, claiming his accusers are lying as part of a vast conspiracy. Evil by Design from our promotional partners at CBC Podcasts asks, who are the women and men who have come forward, and which systems failed them? You can listen to Evil by Design wherever you get your podcasts.
Tens of thousands of demonstrators fill the streets in Myanmar to protest former civilian leader Aung San Suu Kyi's trial, which began this week in secret. Protesters have been calling for the reinstatement of democracy since the military launched a coup on February 1st. And as Nick Schifrin reports, the protesters in Myanmar are also demanding a society that ignores their new military rulers.
At secret locations across Myanmar, healthcare workers who used to work for the government now say they work for the people.
This will be a great trouble for the military to control this kind of civil disobedience movement. It's the kind of protesting, not obeyed and orders prescribed by the military.
This doctor asked us to withhold his name for security reasons. He's on strike from a government hospital and instead treating anti-coup protesters. And he says the doctor's strike is only the beginning.
If the health systems fail and shut down, they might get a lot of problems. We start the movement and ask every ministry and other departments to join us to make a bigger, stronger society movement.
Hundreds of thousands of public servants are on strike as part of a civil disobedience movement, or CDM. They defy military limits on gatherings to launch the country's largest protests in more than 10 years. Firefighters created their own fire brigades. Engineers stopped constructing buildings. When the real police arrived to arrest the doctors, citizen police rushed into the street to protect them, and teachers refused to teach in government schools.
Teachers, lawyers, as well as doctors, they're people we learn from, people who guide us in life.
Eamon Thant is a Burmese journalist who was part of a Reuters team that won a Pulitzer Prize for stories critical of the Burmese military that landed two of its reporters in prison. She says the civil disobedience movement is targeting the states and military's foundations. Protesters heard the military might seize money from banks, so they blocked the central bank and called on bank staff to join the movement. Protests also try to prevent the junta from collecting taxes.
Things that really directly impact the any government's ability to govern and enact their policy and fund what they're doing.
What the military is doing is reversing Myanmar's fragile democracy. The February 1st coup declared a state of emergency and installed army leader Min Aung Hlaing for at least a year. Democratic leader Aung San Suu Kyi is now in house arrest and facing charges that could lead to years of imprisonment. And now the junta is beginning to use violence. In southern Myanmar, police fired rubber bullets. In the north, soldiers fired to disperse the crowd. And this week, for the first time since protests began, soldiers appeared on the streets in armored vehicles. The military spokesman claims civil servants are being manipulated.
We found out that the protesters are inciting the violence and illegally pressuring civil servants. The protesters have become violent rather than peaceful.
But we've seen this resistance and crackdown before. 1998 uprisings against the government were met with a massacre that killed thousands of protesters. But today's Myanmar is less isolated. And young people reluctant to give up democratic gains are more connected and creative. This week, there were breakdancing protesters, musician protesters who played a well-known anthem of resistance, and young men who wanted to infuse the protests with some muscle. Many younger protesters want more than the coup's reversal. They want a new founding document that removes the military's power, says Thant.
There is a contingency who their main demand is the release of Aung San Suu Kyi, like a return to status quo. And then there's another contingency that says, no, that is much more on the side of a more radical change.
As night falls, protesters bang on pots and pans, a tradition to ward off evil spirits.
Hundreds of miles away in Bangladesh, Muslim Rohingya refugees express solidarity. Myanmar's ethnic minorities are especially vulnerable, and no minority has suffered the military's wrath more than the Rohingya. And civilian leaders have not held the military to account. In 2017, Suu Kyi defended the military after the UN accused it of genocide.
I think one other reason that military could have a coup was because they have been enjoying the impunity for the crimes that they have committed over the several decades.
Wei Wei Nu is a Rohingya activist and former political prisoner. She calls for that radical change, a post-coup Myanmar that decentralizes authority to give ethnic minorities more autonomy.
A more inclusive democracy where we embrace our diversity and we assure rights of the people regardless of their ethnicity or a religion. One way to address is to basically draft in a new inclusive, truly federal democratic constitution.
Last week, President Biden sanctioned top Myanmar generals and froze $1 billion of their assets in the U.S. It's a 180 from the last time senior Biden officials were in charge of Myanmar policy. In 2010, the country tentatively opened. In 2011, Suu Kyi met Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. In 2012, President Obama became the first sitting U.S. president to visit, and the U.S. lifted sanctions. Today, the military is back in charge, and protesters want the Biden administration to go further and do what the people have done, go around the junta, and deal only with civilian leadership. The same day Biden's sanctions were announced, healthcare workers shut down their clinic for fear the military would intimidate patients. But the doctor we spoke to says civil disobedience will continue.
Just listen, the voice of the people. Because this is the country that we own, we all need to get our voice is louder than a small group of the military people.
The military, though small, holds the levers of power, but it's outnumbered by protesters who hope to reduce that leverage by creating a society that's run by the people. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
If all goes according to plan, the U.S. will land its most advanced rover ever on Mars by this time tomorrow night, nearly 300 million miles from where it lifted off last year. It is a daunting task, one that will set up a more ambitious exploration of the red planet. Miles O'Brien lays out the nerve-wracking challenges and goals of the mission.
Release and liftoff. As the countdown to Mars continues.
It took 7 months for the Perseverance rover to travel between Earth and Mars. And once it arrives, 7 minutes to descend from the top of the atmosphere to the surface.
A landing on Mars is all about finding a way to stop and stop in the right place.
When it comes to entry, descent, and landing, Al Chen is the man in the hot seat at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. It takes 11 minutes for radio signals to travel the speed of light from Earth to Mars. Too much lag time for Chen and his team to remotely pilot the rover. So Perseverance must land autonomously.
And that's kind of one of the central challenges, I think, of landing on Mars. We can't participate, we can't guide it, we can't pilot it on its own. We have trained Perseverance to do it on her own.
It all culminates with what's called the sky crane. Retro rockets fire on the descent stage, and the rover is winched down to the surface on tethers. It all may seem a little harebrained, but the one time NASA tried it, with the Curiosity rover in 2012, it worked like a charm. Perseverance is aiming for the Jezero crater, which may hold the answer to the big question, did life once exist on the planet next door? Lori Glaze heads NASA's Planetary Science Division.
Jezero really stood out as a potential landing site because within that crater, we can see absolute evidence that there was a lake that persisted there long enough that a river flowed into that crater and deposited all of its, you know, all of its sediments into a river delta.
The crater has been bone dry for 3.5 billion years. But in its wetter, warmer days, this place might have been a rich breeding ground for life, perhaps something resembling bacteria or algae here on Earth.
So if those early microbes were present on Mars, this is exactly the kind of deposit where they would be preserved.
What we are going to be looking for are biosignatures, the leavings of microbial life.
Geologist Ken Farley is the project scientist for the mission.
Everybody is familiar with the idea that living things are made out of organic matter, and some of that gets preserved. And the idea is that using one of the instruments on the rover, we can actually see how that organic matter is distributed.
The science team prepped for the mission in Western Australia. The rocks there are about the same age as those in the Jezero crater.
When we look at these ancient terrestrial rocks that have evidence of life in them, what we see is that microbes formed mats. These are layers at the interface between a lake or a shallow sea and the mud at the bottom that held the sediment together and actually distorted it in very characteristic kind of mushroom-shaped patterns called stromatolites. These are a really obvious kind of biosignature. That will be something that we will be looking for very carefully with the rover.
Perseverance will drill core samples out of rocks that might contain these organic biosignatures. They will be sealed up in tubes and dropped off on the Martian surface for a future rover to collect and send back to Earth. It's a concept called sample return.
So we are so excited about Mars sample return. We are closer now than we've ever been before.
But it's still a ways off. By the time the Retriever rover launches to Mars and a sample is sent to Earth, it will likely be the early 2030s. Biosignatures are signs of possible life, but not smoking gun proof. Teasing out that question will be a lot easier in a lab here on this planet.
But when we get those samples back in the laboratory, that's what's going to give us our best opportunity to be able to say whether or not some of those molecules that we're finding were actually biologic molecules or whether they could form in other ways.
But for now, the star of this rover show may turn out to be this little 4-pound drone helicopter named Ingenuity.
It's a game changer. It's something that will enhance space exploration, period. Is the ability to fly around the planet.
Mimi Ong is the project manager on this technology demonstration experiment. They're planning 5 short test flights. Mars changes the equation for flights with wings or rotors. The gravity is about 1/3 of Earth's, and the carbon dioxide atmosphere is much thinner.
It's about 1% compared to here, right, on Earth. Even though you're able to lift, right? You have to spin very fast to lift. Because the atmosphere is so thin, you can't lift as much mass.
If successful, Ingenuity could usher in a new era of mobile exploration on Mars, a reconnaissance tool to find intriguing sites for science. And it would be a historic first flight on another planet.
It's been a long journey. I'm very goal-oriented. I want to get to learn as much as we can about flight. Think of Wright Brothers experiments, right? A whole series of experiments. We, at Mars, we just get to get one shot, right?
And speaking of shots, Perseverance will aim its cameras at Ingenuity when it flies. Another iconic image of a first flight awaits us. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Miles O'Brien.
So exciting. Fingers crossed. We will talk with Miles live tomorrow night to see if the mission to Mars is a success. In West Africa, there are concerns about a new outbreak of Ebola. The first cases were reported in Guinea a few days ago. Now, those countries and the World Health Organization are racing to contain the problem from spreading. Dr. Paul Farmer is known for his decades of work to bolster public health care around the globe, including in Africa. Jeffrey Brown spoke with Farmer about his new book on the 2014 Ebola crisis and what we can learn from it now during the pandemic.
Hazmat suits, overcrowded wards, bodies of the victims.
scenes we're all now used to amid pandemic, but these images are from the 2014 Ebola epidemic that swept across West Africa, infecting nearly 30,000, killing 11,000. Doctors from abroad arrived in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, the epicenter of the outbreak.
It was frightening. The streets were closed off. There were ambulances and noises everywhere. There, you know, literally sometimes bodies in the streets.
Paul Farmer is a renowned public health doctor and anthropologist who co-founded Partners in Health, an organization that seeks to bring healthcare to the world's most vulnerable populations. His work has taken him all over the globe and raised questions along the way. Who is most impacted by disease? How might things have been done differently? What can be done now? In his new book, the Ebola outbreak becomes a lens to answer some of those questions. It's titled Fevers, Feuds, and Diamonds, Ebola and the Ravages of History.
You were a participant to events described in this book, but this goes well beyond it.
You know, early in the Ebola outbreak, almost all of our attention was turned towards clinical services. But, you know, we kept on bumping into things we didn't understand. And sometimes even our colleagues from Sierra Leone and Liberia didn't understand. And, you know, that just triggered an interest in a deeper understanding of the place, the culture, the history. And so what I was after in the book was to link those two very different kinds of experience.
One important lesson, it didn't have to happen, at least not to such a deadly extent. In West Africa, lack of medical resources and decades of war paved the way.
I've called that part of the world a clinical desert. They just don't have the staff, the stuff, the space, the systems that are required to respond to an epidemic like this. And I wanted to know why. Because every place has its own history. And, you know, that it's important to understand why people are in such dire straits. It's more important to help them get out of those dire straits, but it's important to understand why as well.
Another lesson, diseases reveal the underlying problems and inequities in any society.
There's this confusion that happens at the beginning of many epidemics, the idea that if it's really a novel pathogen and no one is immune, that it's going to be some sort of great leveler. There really are almost no examples in which that's the case. These diseases are never levelers in that sense. They always look for weaknesses in society. They invade these cracks and fissures.
Fissures that have become all too clear in the U.S. COVID response, as communities of color and low-wage workers have been disproportionately affected by the virus.
Here we are in a very different situation with supposedly the most advanced healthcare systems in the world, and yet ours seems to have failed in many ways just as well. What explains that?
Well, I think it failed in a different way from the failure that we saw in West Africa. There, we just lacked completely the staff, the stuff, the space, the systems required to respond. Here we have those, but they're so unevenly stockpiled, right? And we have an entirely patchwork response. And I think we're feeling that unevenness a great deal now in the United States.
And since last April, Partners in Health has worked here in the U.S. with an ambitious contact tracing program in Massachusetts. They're now involved in the vaccine rollout there, as well as in Rwanda.
I mentioned that I thought we had failed differently here. And what I meant by that is in West Africa, what we saw was clinical nihilism. That is the argument that there was nothing we can do. Ebola was too deadly. It wasn't cost effective, sustainable, prudent, feasible to spend all this attention on improving the quality of clinical care. That's a hard sell here in the United States. What I think we see here is not clinical nihilism, it's containment nihilism. In other words, a refusal to do contact tracing, to invest adequately in public health responses. So it's a different kind of failure, but a failure nonetheless.
You write in this book, and perhaps with some sorrow, about how we humans, your phrase is, forget pestilence. We forget what's happened to humans through history.
You know, after a cataclysm like the 1918 influenza epidemic, with such massive loss at the tail end of the worst war in human history, I get why people want to forget. I understand that very well. It just seems to me that we are forgetting some of these lessons at our peril. You have to understand why people wish to forget dreadful events at the same time that someone is maintaining the memory of them so that we can do better next time around.
Hard-earned lessons that have new resonance here and in West Africa, now facing a renewed Ebola outbreak. Farmer told me today the situation there is concerning, but the experience of the past, plus a vaccine developed at the end of the last outbreak, offers reasons for hope. His goal now, implementing a proven strategy of immediately vaccinating anyone in contact with an infected individual. That, he says, can avoid the terrible death toll of the prior epidemic. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown.
Representative Madeleine Dean from Pennsylvania is perhaps best known these days for her high-profile role as a House manager during former President Trump's second impeachment trial. But in a deeply personal and revealing new book, Under Our Roof, written with her son, Harry Conan, together they share for the first time their family's years-long struggle with Harry's addiction. Congresswoman Dean and Harry join us now. It's so good to see both of you. And Harry, let me just start out by saying congratulations on 8 years of recovery. But what I have to ask you, Harry, is when you wrote this book, you couldn't possibly have known that your mother would have just come off of being the manager in this trial of the former president. How hard for you was it, though, to write about something when your family is already in the public eye?
It was challenging. And to hit on the first point, when we first started writing this book, my mom wasn't even elected to Congress yet. So it's been a long time in the making. But doing it in the public eye, I think for us, it's, you know, at this point, it's kind of what we know. But I think we wanted to highlight our story and try to show people that it is okay to continue to tell these stories regardless of where somebody is, because it is such a common issue that impacts so many Americans.
Representative Dean, why was it important to you to write about it?
I think for those reasons. You know, this past year, 81,000 people died of overdose from addiction. That's more than 200 people a day, every single day, 365 days a year. So we thought that if we wrote about our stories and our struggles, and me trying to figure out what was wrong with Harry, Harry manipulating and hiding what was wrong with him, maybe somebody else would see themselves in our struggle, and more importantly, that maybe somebody else would see themselves in the hope that is in recovery, in treatment, in asking for help. We literally hope that this book helps somebody.
The book does go through so much of what you experienced in raw detail. It started when Harry was in high school. And Congresswoman Dean, you write about you saw him changing, the way he looked, the people, the friends he was hanging out with, and yet you still didn't. It took you a long time to understand what was going on. Why was it so hard, do you think?
I think it was a couple of things. On the one hand, I believed I understood something about addiction, and I learned through the process. I had no idea. On the other hand, you know, as a parent, and you have somebody who's in junior high and high school, you think maybe this is normal adolescence. But I saw the core features, the gifts, the beautiful gifts of Harry just seeping away over the course of a couple of years. He is pretty good at telling a story, as you might have noticed in the book, now with honesty, but back then with manipulation. And so it took me a long time. I think stigma was in our way. That's one of the things we want to try to fight here. We want to try to stop the stigma, because even though I thought I knew something, it turns out I really didn't. Lots of things like that.
And Harry, the two of you take turns writing the book. And you come from, I mean, you come from a comfortable family, loving parents. A lot of people, I think, want to believe that people turn to drugs or alcohol because they've had a traumatic time growing up. How do you explain that to people?
I think if we look at this as a disease and substance use disorder as a disease, it makes that easier to understand. It is common if somebody has experienced a trauma, especially in childhood, maybe there's a higher likelihood of falling into a substance use disorder. But I know from my own personal experience and from that of many people that I've gotten to know through being in recovery, this disease doesn't discriminate, and this disease can come and impact any family.
And Harry, you use the word discriminate. I know there are people who say, you know, you didn't end up in jail, you didn't go to prison. A lot of people would look at your situation and say, well, he's white, comfortable family, you live in a comfortable part of Philadelphia. If you were black, if you live somewhere else, how do you think about that, about privilege?
It's a huge part of my experience. I write in the book about, you know, the color of my skin, the socioeconomic status, where I lived, all of these things really as the pillars that held together my freedom. And through recovery, I've had an opportunity to try to give back and go into CFCF is a local jail in Philadelphia, because there's no fair reason as to why I don't have a criminal record and so many others do. So I try to expose that in the book, because that is a big factor for my recovery. And, you know, it's something that not being caught in the criminal justice system has allowed me to really thrive, because I'm not held back in some ways that so many others unfairly and unjustly are.
That's one of the things, Judy, we wanted to examine and expose. What role did white privilege play in Harry's path? Obviously, it made his path, even though it was a very difficult one, a whole lot easier than a whole lot of other people. Also, his socioeconomic status. We visited Karen Fromhold Prison, and we tell of that in the book. And I very honestly say it's a prison that could have been his own, because I know there's an awful lot of mothers who have children in that prison, and they are in that prison because of a disease. Substance abuse disorder, addiction. We got to do something about that.
And Harry, I know you have spent time talking to others who are experiencing addiction. So we know there's so many who relapse. Why do you think you haven't?
It's hard to pinpoint why I haven't. But what I can say to highlight recovery is I think the beginning is really, really challenging. You know, going from active addiction and the hopelessness and despair that goes along with that, the shame and the just self-loathing that I felt, that didn't just go away the moment that I stopped using drugs. It took time and effort. But another thing we're trying to highlight in the book, Under Our Roof, is what is possible through recovery, the joys that are possible through recovery.
And given how prevalent addiction is in our society, Congresswoman Dean, and especially now during this pandemic, what do you say to other parents who are worried about this for their children, or family members who are worried about it for anyone they love?
I would say ask for help yourself. Early on in my struggles trying to figure out what was going on with Harry, what was going wrong with Harry, I reached out to another mother in the neighborhood. We sat down and had the longest cup of coffee, and she really gave me some clarity of what probably was going on, even though I couldn't exactly see it up close and personal. She also gave me ideas for resources. I would say to people, and I really say this sincerely, that there is always hope. There's nothing worse than when I talk to a parent and that hope has somewhat drained from their eyes. There is always hope, and I say it to the parents or a family member or a loved one. But I also say it to the person who is suffering from addiction. I say it to the addict. And I think Harry didn't realize this at the time, that he could have reached a hand and said, Mom, I need help. Dad, I need help. We were there. But too often, the person who is struggling with the disease, they feel such shame, and they've gone through such trauma themselves that they don't know it. So I say to anybody who either has a loved one or is struggling with it themselves, raise your hand. You'd be surprised at who wants to help you.
Well, it is such an inspiring story, even as it had to be so difficult to live through. Thank you both. Harry Canaan, Representative Madeleine Dean.
Thank you, Judy.
Thank you.
When Kev Marcus and Will B met in a high school music class, they shared their desire to disrupt people's impressions of what classical music should be. Together, they formed a group called Black Violin, which we featured on the NewsHour early on in their success. Well, they're back in tonight's Brief But Spectacular as part of our arts and culture coverage, Canvas.
People ask me, you know, if what do I do? What's in this case? You know, I tell them it's a viola, it's a violin, and they respond is you don't play classical, do you? You know, is that what you do?
No.
Like with a serious face,
not
like
you.
Not classical, right? I mean, there's no way you don't play classical.
Whole life, everybody was like, even in my family, I'm like, why you have Kevin playing the violin? Like, that's not, you know, he's not supposed to be doing that. I always listen to those type of things, and I'm like, oh, well, I guess we're not supposed to be, you know, violinists because we're black. Well, we're going to be the blackest violinist you've ever seen. We approach it very, very classically, but, you know, so the violin part of it is always very, you know, Baroque, Bach, Mozart-like, not much sliding, not much jazz, but the beats and the everything that's around it is all hard-hitting, dirty.
It's fun, it's very inclusive. We have people dancing in the house, and our music just really brings people together.
We're able to blend and go between these different genres, and that's why it brings a really wide, large audience of people. I grew up in a tough neighborhood, and I guess my mom wanted me to get away from some of my friends because I was, you know, going down the wrong path. So she put me in this Saturday music program with the hopes that I would get into the performing arts middle school. So I would be bussed away from my friends. And that's exactly what ended up happening. I went to performing arts school and just was able to focus on violin.
I went to the class the first day and I noticed all these wood instruments. I was looking for the cool instruments, the saxophones and the trumpets. And they told me that I got put in this class and we were staff partners. And obviously I was, you know, first, but I was, you know,
The truth.
I was better. We've always really fed off each other and competed against each other. And we made each other better.
We've always just made good music. And every time we get together, the vibe was always right. So, you know, I feel like looking back, it kind of made sense that we have a 20-year career together now, because that's how it was in high school. My college professor, my first day of class, gives me a tape back in 1999. He tells me, go home and listen to this tape and then come tell me about it next week. So I pop this tape in and it's like a violin on fire. Like a violin with soul, and I never heard a violin played like that before. But when I listened to it, I could tell it was a black guy playing it, and I never had that experience with the violin. So it just changed my entire perception of what the violin could do. And I gave the tape to Will, and he was vibing it too. Many years later, we named ourselves after the inspiration, the thing that changed our entire perception. This tape was recorded by a violinist. His name was Stuff Smith. This is his last album he recorded before he died, and that album was called Black Violin. That album changed the way we perceive the violin, so now the name Black Violin continues to change and challenge people's perceptions.
It's nothing like doing something that you absolutely love and affecting people at the same time. No amount of Grammys, no amount of money can really do that for you.
Ultimately, I've always played the violin because no one expects me to do it, and I like changing people's perceptions and what is possible. We are Black Violin. I am Kev Marcus.
Will Baptiste.
And this has been our brief but spectacular take on defying stereotypes.
Educating a lot of us about the violin. Thank you both. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening for all of us at the PBS NewsHour. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.